to the Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. And who are you? For today's show, I've picked three different stories that peek into how we perceive others. To start it all off, a speculation about just who we share our daily commutes with. From independent radio producer Luke Eldridge, here is his meditation on the people who fill the seats on his local bus line.
The X7 bus takes the route from Leicester to Northampton. First, along the A6 dual carriageway, and then where I get on, the A508, that winds through the gentle hills of the county. The doors swing open, I show my annual pass, and take a seat amongst the familiar faces. Those familiar faces. There is the gamer. His game of choice is Angry Birds, a game unfamiliar to me, but one that I've established involves catapulting an animated bird at a pile of blocks with the objective of destroying them. Being coerced into doing this is, presumably, what makes the bird angry. The gamer plays Angry Birds the entire time I'm on the bus with him. 2 hours a day. He travels further than me, so maybe it's more. But by my reckoning, he catapults that poor bird 3,600 times every week, yet never seems to get bored of it. There is Bluebag, who every day commits that most despised of acts by us bus users, taking up a spare seat with her luggage. Sure, we'd all love a seat for our luggage, but when demand outstrips supply, we all have to take a little less. That's bus economics. There is the retired mod, with his narrow jeans and Paul Weller haircut, who smiles at everybody. He may have discarded his antagonism, but he's kept his image. And the cast runs to many more. The Southeast Asian porters, clean and crisp in their uniforms. The alternative college girls with their asymmetric haircuts. And the mature student who reads Greek mythology. And like all great cultures, we have established and determined our social norms. Most notably, in these 10 hours each week we spend together, we do not talk. There is, of course, so much to talk about. For our children have started to walk, our aunties are emigrating, our brothers have got promotions, and our cats need to go to the vets. And us? We've started new diets, just bought iPad 3s, had our hair cut, and had a bad night's sleep. But we don't talk about these things, for we say nothing. And that is what we've agreed.
That piece was produced by Luke Eldridge and was a winner of the 2012 Third Coast Short Docs Challenge, which invited anyone and everyone to produce short audio works featuring at least two neighbors, a color in the title, and 3 consecutive seconds of narrative silence. You can find more selections from the archives of the Third Coast International Audio Festival at their website, thirdcoastfestival.org. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to their podcast. Peter Finch is no stranger to the Bay Area radio community. His short and quirky audio documentaries have been featured on KFOG and KGO Radio here in San Francisco, and he's even an inductee in the Bay Area Radio Hall of Fame. In 2014, Peter launched the podcast The Finch Files, Stories of San Francisco and Beyond, which features little-known histories, personal experiences, and sonic explorations all about our beloved Bay Area. It's a pretty fun podcast. Just listen for yourself.
The year was 1998. The horse race meet was underway at Golden Gate Fields, which sits bayside on the Berkeley-Albany border. Joelle Dunlap was working special events at the track.
And it was a Friday night. I only remember that because that was the only nighttime we raced. And this skinny, tiny little guy in a weird hat ambles up to me and some other folks and declares that he's the bass player for ZZ Top.
And what was the reaction?
Wow, and we treated him like royalty.
The bass player, Dusty Hill, and his trademark long flowing beard were whisked down to the winner's circle to have a photo taken. There, says Joelle, the celebrity rocker was greeted by Art Lobato, a friendly former jockey who works at the track.
As they snapped the camera shot, both he and this guy did the signature, you know, whoop around and windmill point thing.
Right.
And it was very, very cute. It was really, really cute. And he definitely had the moves, so it could be him.
Or was it? Joelle says at first, nobody had expressed doubt.
No, I was really excited at first. It wasn't until later where we realized how much he was enjoying all the attention. We thought, wow, we have no way to prove or disprove this. And it's all kind of a little bit odd. We all started kind of looking at each other like, you know, these guys are famous for being incognito, and I don't think this is the bass player for ZZ Top. And then the more we looked at how much he was enjoying himself, the more sure we were that we've been had.
Thing is, nobody wanted to be rude and confront the guy, so everybody played along. And that was the end of it. Except not really, because the guy returned to Golden Gate Fields.
You know, he did. He showed up at the track a couple of times, and nobody really wanted to question it, and he didn't ask for much, so we just kind of let it roll.
Joelle Dunlap says the ZZ Top impersonator didn't seem to be hurting anybody, so why not play along?
I think he's had a lot of free drinks, and that's never a bad thing, I'm sure.
Played the part pretty well.
He played the part really well. I hope somewhere, somehow, he's playing the part right now, because that was fun.
That story was produced by Peter Finch. You can find the latest from his podcast, Stories of San Francisco and Beyond, at his website, finchfiles.net. You'll also find the podcast now on iTunes. You're listening to KALW's The Spot, the show that features the best stories from podcasts and independent radio producers. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. We all know about the podcast Serial. Though I doubt I'll ever feature it on The Spot, I do want to note that what I enjoy most about Serial is their long-form approach to tell one story, chopped up into serialized episodes. Well, there's a new serialized podcast in town, literally in our town, San Francisco. It's called Subframe, and it's produced by a team of documentary makers in partnership with the California Historical Society. In their first season, Subframe told the story of the Panama Pacific International Exposition of 1915, also known as the PPIE, that was held here in San Francisco. In this episode of Subframe from 2015, author and historian Laura Ackley sets the scene in the skies above San Francisco.
The Great Scintillator was a brilliant rainbow-colored fan of light that could be projected into the San Francisco fog over the city. It could touch the Marin foothills. It could be seen from many of the counties around. And it consisted of 48 huge spotlights, each 4 feet across. And these were mounted in a way that they had freedom of movement in all three directions. It took a battery of 60 Marines to run the scintillator, and it was run like a military drill. Pacific Service Magazine, which was the magazine for PG&E, wrote, quote, "On receiving a color command, an apparently wild scramble ensues, but in 5 seconds, the screens are in place, the lamps trained to position, and behold, the aurora," unquote. The fog was a tremendous asset to the scintillator. And as we know, sometimes the fog, when you want it, is recalcitrant and doesn't show up. Walter Darcy Ryan, who many termed a crazy man, had a 228-ton Southern Pacific locomotive brought in and mounted above the ground so they could run it at what would have been 60 miles an hour just to produce steam and smoke to project the scintillator into.
Hey guys, you're listening to Subframe. That was author and historian Laura Ackley setting the mood for this episode with her description of the scintillator.
The scintillator was mounted on a pier near the yacht harbor that stuck out into the bay, and on kind of an opposite pier was this giant locomotive mounted above the ground that he had even had painted the same color as the palace walls, because of course no one's going to notice a huge train puffing away at 60 miles an hour. It also powered the supplementary steam tubes, which shot up steam on command. So they were called fireless fireworks, because they would look like little creatures crawling through the beams of the spotlights.
I'm trying to imagine a rainbow of colors over San Francisco every single evening, sometimes mingling with the fog during a very formative time in the city's history. Welcome to episode 2 of this season on the PPIE, the Panama Pacific International Exposition, in partnership with the California Historical Society. Kip Rinesmith, producer and co-conspirator here at Subframe, produced this episode. Kip, why don't you take us there?
Tony, this episode we're going to talk about gender roles at the fair and the larger implications that those roles had on race and also society. As a trans man, I am constantly amused and baffled by gender and society's notions of gender. Luckily, I'm living in a society that makes space for me, or at least is trying to, and it makes space for fluidity of expression and fluidity of gender. But the roles that men and women found themselves in 1915 were interesting in that they were sort of at the precipice of change, but not quite change itself. Tony, I want to start this episode off by talking about technology.
Wait, I thought this episode was about gender roles in San Francisco in the year 1915.
No, it is. It definitely is. But, you know, I don't think we can talk about gender before we tackle the role of technology and how people viewed that. I mean, it turns out technology was pretty gendered. Hint, it still is. Ask Apple why they didn't include tracking for women's menstrual cycles when they released their revolutionary health app that's supposed to be universal. But I digress. Then, as it is now, gender was used as a lens to understand the world. By personifying and then embodying events in time in the male or the female form, gender was used as a shorthand for other things and other meanings. I want to start by looking at the perception of maleness through the lens of technology in 1915.
I would argue that technology is sort of the primary narrative through which America defined itself as a nation from the beginning to its triumphant moment with the opening of the Panama Canal.
That's Sarah J. Moore, author of Empire on Display, San Francisco's Panama Pacific International Exposition of 1915.
The technological forces to build the canal had a kind of prowess and sort of intense masculinity in a way.
One of the key pieces of technology used to dig the canal was a large steam shovel called the Bisyrus shovel.
The Bisyrus shovel, that multi-ton monster that was like a monster digging machine, as it were, that was the primary machine that people visualized and imagined did the work of the canal. And so I don't think it was any coincidence that that's where Theodore Roosevelt had himself photographed in 1906.
In his memoirs, Roosevelt wrote, "The Panama Canal would not have started if I had not taken hold of it."
I mean, of course, there's many well-known images of Roosevelt, but that's probably the most iconic in a way, in the sense of sort of man, Superman, because he was not just leaning against it or pointing at it or chatting with one of the guys who was driving it, but that he was actually at the controls. So, you know, how premeditated that was, I have absolutely no idea. But it was a brilliant moment in the sense of the technological know-how. What we need is the might, conflating all those ideas of the manly will of the nation to be able to harness the tools of technology.
Progress, and in PPIE's case, progress through technology, was clearly gendered male. One of the most recognizable images and the poster that became the official image of the fair is one rendered by Purim Nal called The 13th Labor of Hercules. Moore describes it for us.
What it shows is a hyper-muscular nude male shown from the side and literally inserting his body and pressing with his arms against the sides of the earth. The earth arches up as a sort of mountainous peak, so we've got the Pacific and the Atlantic mingling at his footsteps, and then in the misty distance down at his feet is an evocation of the fairgrounds. Civilization literally being born by this eroticized and very, I suppose, violent encounter between the force of the nation, which is embodied as male, and the earth, which at least historically is always gendered female. I want nobody but you, $100.
No one but you, baby. No one but you. So, where are the women in all of this? The concept of the modern woman, the odd woman, was just beginning. A Vanity Fair article published in 1915 by Hyman Strunsky remarks on this phenomenon of the odd woman. He writes,
"The odd woman has odd notions about marriage, the oddest of which is that she thinks it is largely her own affair. She has discovered that there are other vocations besides being a wife. She has become a worker, a useful member of society, a fellow citizen in an industrial democracy. She is not the inferior, but the equal of man. She is odd."
But honestly, men were responsible for most, if not all, of the engineering feats at the fair, mostly because women just didn't even have a chance at the time. So what then did women have responsibility over? Where were they? Well, we can't really talk about women and their roles at the fair without getting into the women's board. We talked with Abigail Marquin, author of Empress San Francisco, a really fantastic book with lots of pictures if you like pictures and you're like me and you like shiny things.
There was no official women's building at the fair, but there was a women's board. It was founded by elite Bay Area women during the planning stages of the fair, and they were eventually incorporated into the administrative structure of the fair itself. Don't put a tax on the beautiful girl. In many ways, the women's board engaged in activities that in some ways were stereotypically quite female. That official role was as the hostess of the California building, the hostesses of the California building.
There's an image that sums up the attitude and the general vibe at the time that I want to share with you. The women of the Women's Board decided to erect a statue dedicated to womanhood, to the founding mothers, as it were, of the Western frontier. To bring more attention to women at the fair, they formed a group, they raised money, and they commissioned a piece from sculptor Charles Grapley. They called it the Pioneer Mother. She's clothed in relatively ragged, quaint, what we might call prairie clothing, a hand-sewn dress, a bonnet, worn-out boots. In front of her are her two naked children, earnestly and optimistically trudging forward towards the great unknown, the frontier, the wild, wild west, as it were, over mountains and prairies. But that's not all they were marching over. Marquin helps us break it down.
It was intended as a monument to the mothers. The women of the Women's Board saw those women as responsible for building the civilization of California. And it was very clear in their mind that woman was white, that woman was of middling or elite status. That was not a poor woman, it was not a California woman, it was not an Asian woman, it was not a Native American woman. All women that were in the state as well in the 19th century.
And by the way, if you're interested in seeing the Pioneer Mother, you can find it in Golden Gate Park. It's currently near Stowe Lake and the Pioneer Log Cabin, and it's actually the only statue of a woman in all of Golden Gate Park.
It eventually occupied a place of honor in front of the Palace of Fine Arts and was a very popular statue during the fair. And so I see that as one way in which the Women's Board in some ways chose to create a version of what we might call women's history in a way that I think we can look to in a positive manner in some ways. But on the other hand, the underlying narrative of that statue is very much one based on racist premises and very much based on the conquest of California and the removal of land from, you know, of course, indigenous peoples as well as the Californios.
I'd like to stop and compare these two iconic images that we have of the fair. The 13th Labor of Hercules and the Pioneer Mother. Interestingly, the female representation of the Pioneer Mother honors the past of the female, while the male perception of himself as Hercules speaks towards the future expectations of men. So, even though there were many differences among these images, they had something really big in common. Both are made with the implication of pushing aside, ignoring, and destroying the lives of indigenous peoples. Back to the women's board.
So the official role of women at the fair was as hostess, and also they were in charge of what's called moral protection or moral welfare work. So they were supposed to be charged with making sure that San Francisco was a safe place for travelers, particularly women, and particularly unaccompanied young women. That reflected a lot of social anxieties at the turn of the century and into the 19-teens. Americans were plagued by a fear of what was called white slavery, which meant that they believed that young white women were being kidnapped, essentially, and forced into prostitution. And this was a huge scare that was still very much around by 1915 and certainly in the years leading up to the fair.
To get a sense of what was going on back then, look up the silent film Traffic in Souls by George Lone Tucker. Made in 1913, it tells the story of two Swedish sisters who come to the U.S. looking for work. One of the women is kidnapped to be sold into prostitution. The film was a pretty big success, so it's easy to speculate how this film could have been on the minds of fairgoers.
It was also fed by stories that had come out of earlier expositions of young women who had left to go work at the fair. Because, of course, these fairs generate a lot of jobs. And by the turn of the century, it's becoming more acceptable for women to work for a few years before they get married. And the reality was a lot of those jobs were not very good. A lot of them were factory jobs, perhaps department store jobs or secretarial jobs, but a lot of them were not always as high paying as people might like.
Many members of the Women's Board were also members of the board of the YWCA, and the two worked closely together.
The YWCA, the Young Women's Christian Association, was very involved in reform work and welfare work and focused on young women. At the fair, the National YWCA erected a building, the YWCA building, and in some ways that building was a little bit like a women's building. It was erected by a group of women who were interested in conveying a particular view of civilization. And what's interesting is that they were very much conveying a world that was run by and administered by women, and one in which women could be businesswomen, women could be school teachers, women could be lawyers, women could hold a number of different positions and a number of different careers, which of course was very much against the grain of mainstream society in 1915. Their goal was to basically offer services to the young women that worked on the zone. And it, as far as I can tell, they served all the young women of the zone. So they served women who worked as dancing girls, they served women who worked as cashiers, they served women who worked as waitresses.
We'll explore the zone a little deeper in another episode, but for now, I want to say that the zone that she's referring to was officially called the Joy Zone. The Joy Zone was a place that you went to relax, to go on rides, to get to experience different cultures, as it were, and see the sights. It was also a deeply racist place in its depictions of other cultures. Think Epcot, but like a million times worse.
So there are reports that talked about a dinner that they held in which there were Japanese women and Hawaiian women and women from a variety of different backgrounds all together, all being served in the same way. This suggests to me that there was some level of integration at the fair, at least, which does stand somewhat in contrast to the Y's activities in other parts of the country, which often were segregated.
But the Y was more than just a place to rest. It was also tied to the suffrage movement. The fight for women's suffrage certainly didn't start at the turn of the century. It was already in progress more than 20 years before the Civil War in 1861. Suffragist efforts died down when the war started, but then geared back up after the war. Women in California weren't granted the right to vote until 1911. That's almost 3/4 of a century after its introduction as a platform. But many states were still struggling in a fight not dissimilar to the recent struggle for marriage equality, in that the federal government had decided to leave the issue of women's suffrage up to individual states. And even then, the measures did not secure full equality for women, only the right to vote, which they saw as a stepping stone for equality. This left many states fighting for their rights over years and years, making it both costly and extremely time-consuming. Side note, while writing this episode, the fight for marriage equality was still stuck in limbo while we waited on the Supreme Court's ruling. It thrills me to be able to add this addendum. As you have probably already heard by now, the Supreme Court ruled on June 26, 2015, that it is legal in all 50 states for same-sex couples to be married. Okay, back to the struggle.
And then there's another really interesting moment in the suffrage story when the suffragists host an international suffrage convention in June of 1915 at the fair. And their intent is to display to fairgoers and newspaper readers and anybody else the other nations and states that had suffrage, that had the vote, in which women had the vote. And so they had women speak and appear at the fair who represented places around the world where women, in fact, had the vote. There's a picture that appears in the Chronicle the next day that depicts a Chinese woman, Madame Chen Qi, who was a very important figure at the fair, and also depicted two young women from Alaska, both of whom appeared in sort of their full native garb. It always makes me question what the suffragist motives were, right? Were they in fact trying to give these women a voice, or were they trying to shame the establishment and the opponents to women's suffrage with the fact that these supposedly inferior women in fact had the vote when white women did not?
It was complicated and it was not pretty. But the role of women was shifting slowly, and arguably at the cost of leaving others behind. At the very least, there was change brewing.
I mean, Roosevelt had a bee in his bonnet about this whole thing, that men were becoming ostensibly increasingly less manly, which of course is a big problem. But even worse, which then of course ties into the whole suffrage issue, is that if men are becoming less manly, then women are becoming more so. So men are becoming effeminized, women are becoming masculinized, and so we've got gender Armageddon happening.
Gender Armageddon. I'm basically a walking advertisement for gender Armageddon. It's true that I identify as male, and I understand the implications that that has in our society, but I'd like to think that I have one important distinction from the average white male, and that is my past. And it's easy to look back 100 years and call out the absurdities and the atrocities, the racism and the inequality. It's a lot harder to look at our present day situation and find a peaceful resolution. You know, by casting a light on all those shadows, we get to face them and we can promise to be better. Thanks so much for listening.
This episode was produced by Kip Rinesmith and was edited and co-produced by me, Tony Gannon, with production support from Johanna Hoffman. Subframe has partnered with the California Historical Society to give you cinematically driven history, this season focusing on the Panama Pacific International Exposition. This episode featured Professor Sarah J. Moore from the University of Arizona, Associate Professor Abigail Marquin of Carroll University, author and historian Laura Ackley, and voiceover acting by Jordan Gannon. You can find relevant links to this episode at our website, www.subframe.fm. We'd like to thank the entire staff of the California Historical Society, especially Anthea Hardig, Kathy Young, Adam Hirschfelder, and most especially, Patty Ford.
If you live in the Bay Area and haven't been to visit the California Historical Society yet, shame on you. Go check out their exhibit on the PPIE right now at their location in downtown San Francisco. They also have one currently at the Palace of Fine Arts. Stay abreast of all their awesome programming and happenings at californiahistoricalsociety.org.
Thank you for listening.
That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Tune in next Thursday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.